from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour...
Secret FBI memos made public today show that the late J. Edgar Hoover ordered a nationwide campaign to disrupt the activities of the new left.
In 1971, a group of burglars broke into an FBI office and stole boxes of documents that revealed the federal agency's secret spying on dissident groups. Decades later, some of those burglars have revealed themselves to former Washington Post reporter Betty Metzger, who wrote the original story about the break-in and FBI spying back in 1971. She'll join us to talk about the people behind the break-in and the impact of what they found, and we'll consider the changes in the country and the government in the more than 40 years between the release of those files and Edward Snowden, next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Nearly 43 years ago, a group of burglars who called themselves the Citizen Committee to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, and stole files of FBI surveillance of anti-war groups and civil rights organizations. The content of the files was made public and had a major impact on the FBI and the iconic image held for many years of the Bureau and its chief, J. Edgar Hoover, and the burglars were never caught. The Washington Post reporter who broke the original story and who decades later had some of those burglars reveal themselves to her was Betty Metzger, who was the author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. She's a former Washington Post reporter, and she's also a former journalism department chair at San Francisco State University, where she founded the Center for Integration and Improvement of Journalism, and where I had the privilege of teaching with her for many years. And so good to have you back on Forum, Betty.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you. Delighted. And, this is quite a story. I thought maybe to begin really revealing the story and all of its contours and nuances as best we can to listeners, we might hear something that really was broadcast earlier, I think by the New York Times, of John Raines, one of the burglars who broke into an FBI office, and he kind of dropped a bombshell on you. Let's hear this cut.
And our youngest daughter, Mary, was there. I said, Mary, you really ought to know Betty, because she was the one that we sent all those documents to. And Betty's chin dropped like that.
You want to validate how much your chin dropped? Or?
Well, I was pretty shocked. This was many years after I had received and written about the dockets, and many years after the files they released had their great impact. And I was living in California at the time, and I had trips to make to Missouri and Massachusetts. And in between, I gave myself the gift of a weekend in Philadelphia, where I had worked before I was in Washington. And I filled that weekend with appointments with acquaintances and former colleagues. And one evening, I was having dinner with the Raines, and that John described it accurately. I was shocked. I never had any idea who the burglars were, had not tried to find out, and I don't think that I could have, probably, if I had tried. So that was quite a revelation, and that was the beginning. I mean, just a short time after that, from what I learned from them that evening about what they had done and who the other people were, I told them that I was interested in writing the book. So that really was the beginning of my second involvement with the burglars, but not anonymous this time.
And John Raines, we should mention, as a retired professor of religion at Temple University, we're going to be talking to him later. He was a freedom writer in Selma, Alabama, going even back before then. But they really passed a long way beyond the 5-year statute of limitations. So there was a silence vow that lasted so long. I mean, it just came out, was blurted out at dinner. But why did it last as long as it did, do you think?
Well, they told me that evening that, in fact, they had the last time that the group was together, which was 10 days after the burglary, and as they completed the sorting of the documents and preparing the packages that they would then send out every 10 days to 2 weeks for about 2 months, that on that last occasion that they were together, that they had vowed to each other that they would take this secret to their graves. They weren't thinking about, you know, expiration of statutes or anything, but they planned to never reveal this and to also not see each other, that they were concerned at that time about what associating with each other could mean, that if one was arrested, it could lead to the arrest of the other. It also has some – the fact that they kept the secret so long, I think, also has something to do with the unusual nature of these people, beginning with the leader of the group, Bill Davidson. He was a physics professor at Haverford who got the idea for the burglary and then invited the others to think about it and then to plan it together. They all of them had some of his key qualities. He was a very modest person while at the same time being a very passionate person, particularly about the war, stopping the war. His main motivation, in fact, in regard to the war, was the nuclear weapons and trying to stop the use of nuclear weapons, and his deep fear that because they were on the table that either Johnson or Nixon would use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So their personalities were such that they didn't have egos that needed to brag. In my years as a reporter, I've covered people in a wide range of movements, and you often find people who, as leaders of movements or as people who have done significant things, really want credit quite a bit. And these people were not that way. They were able to live knowing that they had accomplished this very significant thing and not demand credit for it. So that night, 2 weeks after that night, back in California, I couldn't think of much else. And I wrote to them and I said, you know, I know you've taken that vow, but I hope you'll reconsider that this is an important missing piece of American history. What you did was so significant. I still think that it's one of the most powerful acts of nonviolent resistance in the country's history. And I told them that I hoped that they could agree that they cooperate with my interviewing them for a book, and would they try to find the other burglars. And they did agree that they wanted to cooperate, and then they set out to find the others.
I think I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that there were 8 burglars,
yes,
and 7 of them were found, and 2 chose not to have their names used, but all 7 cooperated extensively in telling their stories.
And the FBI, we should have mentioned, sent out hundreds of agents. They had a list of who they thought were the likely suspects, and none of them were really close to the mark. But I think it's also important to tell these people's story because they were ordinary Americans for the most part. I mean, they were, as you characterize them, hardworking, anti-war people who were principled, who had the belief, and the belief was pretty much corroborated by, well, the work that they did in terms of gathering information that surveillance was going on, that the FBI was violating and transgressing, and that something ought to be done to expose the FBI because nobody else was going to do it in government or in the media.
Well, that's right. This many years removed, it's probably important to describe what the atmosphere was like between Americans and the FBI or any of the intelligence agencies. J. Edgar Hoover was an iconic figure, really much loved, portrayed in television series, movies. Ever since the 30s, there had just been countless movies that portrayed the FBI and him, but also he had the right to edit them. And there was almost no newspaper coverage of the FBI. You could count on fewer than the fingers of one hand the number of journalists who had raised questions or done any investigative reporting on the FBI.
Forgive me, Betty. It would be safe to say when the image was one of invincibility, fearlessness, and integrity of the FBI and of Hoover.
That's right. That's right. Oh, yeah. That's definitely right. He truly was an idolized, iconic figure and had been for generations. He had been the director of the FBI since 1924, appointed by Harlan Stone Fisk when Hoover was just 29 years old. Probably the longest serving appointed official in history, but also, without a doubt, to this day, the most powerful appointed official in U.S. history and much feared by the people who normally would be expected to provide oversight of the FBI, members of Congress and the presidents that he served under and the attorney generals who were his titular bosses. But you're right in what you said. The burglars had this intuitive, I guess is not quite strong enough a word. People at that time in the peace movement and in the civil rights movement had this very strong suspicion that there were spies in their midst. And it was having a very poisonous impact on organizations. Trust was fraying. And Bill Davidson, I think I mentioned, was a physicist, very much committed to the scientific method and not a believer in conspiracies. And in 1970, he kept hearing from people in the various peace movement organizations that he was in that they thought that there were spies in their midst. And at first he thought that people were just very discouraged because the war wasn't ending and that they were imagining things perhaps. But then as he heard it more and more and from very reasonable people, he came to believe it was true. And his whole life he had been deeply committed to preserving dissent. And he thought that if this is true, if the government is officially suppressing dissent through the FBI, that this is a crime against democracy and it's a crime that needs to be stopped. And that was a very real commitment to him and then to the others he brought in. And it made them think that they thought it was such a serious crime that they were willing to risk many years in prison in order to get the evidence. And that's the word that he used, that the American public will believe that this is true only if we can provide physical evidence. But they had no idea whether there was a single page of evidence in that little FBI office that would be valuable.
We're talking to Betty Metzger, the author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, former Washington Post reporter who initially covered Hoover's spying based on these documents in 1971. And you talked about, you know, trying to sort of reestablish what things were like back then, particularly in terms of the FBI. And the reality now is, and certainly we know this to be a fact because of these documents and because of other declassified documents that have come to light, there was a good deal of spying. There was a good deal of surveillance. There was an attempt really to stir up dissident groups to create even more paranoia among them. And one of the other things about these particular documents was that COINTELPRO was mentioned, the infamous counterintelligence program, which a lot of things were not known about even at that time, but came to light afterward. But this also occurred, this burglary, soon after the invasion of Cambodia.
That's right. The invasion of Cambodia was announced by Nixon at the end of April in 1970, and this was just about a year later. But you're right, and I think what you perhaps are suggesting was the atmosphere that was created by the invasion of Cambodia. Is that right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was saying. And I think also the sense that there was a lot that was being done essentially to harbor enmity within dissident groups themselves. There was even, I guess it turned out from these documents, letter writers who files were made, anti-Vietnam letter writers to newspapers who files were established on. Things that the American public not only had no idea of, but really brought to light just how, I suppose, anti-democratic much of what the FBI was about at that time.
Yes, that's a very important point, Michael. I think it is it's probably difficult for people to imagine that the political spying operations and the dirty tricks operations, which is really what COINTELPRO was, weren't just done against extreme groups. although they certainly did go against what were regarded as extreme groups and often doing things that made them extreme. But it also happened to very ordinary people. As you said, people who did something as simple as write a letter to the editor of their local newspaper expressing opposition or raising questions about the Vietnam War. I remember reading in the files about a Nation author who wrote an article that was critical. And the Nation was one of the few publications that wrote regularly about the FBI. And soon all the neighbors of that person had files, were visited by FBI agents, and then had files that went on to last for years and years.
We should mention also that this burglary was meticulously planned. It turned out to be a perfect crime because it was never discovered who was responsible or culpable, but to the point of it actually occurring on the night of the Joe Frazier-Ali fight, a 15-round fight. Most Americans had their attention on their television sets or listening to that fight on the radio. And the people who were involved in this actually prepared those friends of theirs whom they deemed to be responsible enough to take care of their children. I mean, they were really ready to go to whatever consequences would result. And I thought we would talk with a couple of them. John Raines was one of the burglars who broke into an FBI office, stealing nearly all the documents and leaking them to the media. He's a retired professor of religion at Temple University. His wife, Bonnie, was part of the team of burglars, and she also worked as a child care advocate for many years. John Raines, good to have you with us. Bonnie Raines, welcome.
John Raines is. Just a minute, I'll get Bonnie on.
Okay.
Bonnie, pick up.
Be on the same line. While Bonnie is picking
right,
up,
come on.
Bonnie, hi. Glad to have you both here. We have Betty Metzger on as well. And I thought we'd hear just a quick clip. I was talking about how meticulous this crime was planned. Mm-hmm. One of the burglars who was involved with you, Tim Forsyth, who was going to be the lock picker, but discovered a bit of a problem. He was a taxi driver. He took a course in lockpicking and said they wanted to find the documents to get the smoking gun and what the extent of the FBI spying and tricks were. And here's Tim Forsyth actually talking about that whole burglary.
We're not going to make any allegations. We're going to take their own paperwork signed by their own people, including J. Edgar Hoover, and give it to the newspapers. So let's see you argue with that.
That was the spirit of things, I guess. Bonnie Raines, John Raines, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really was. I think we felt very compelled at that point in time to get something, some evidence that could not be refuted.
Well, also, J. Edgar Hoover was untouchable in Washington, D.C. He was more powerful than presidents. Presidents would be president only 8 years at most, and he was a director of the FBI for nearly five decades and imposed his own biases in a highly hierarchical fashion upon the practices of all the agents. And yet the people that were supposed to hold him responsible, ask tough questions and so on, they never did. They were either enamored of the man or terrified of the man.
Well, he had files on just about everybody, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, including presidents.
And when we heard Tim Forsyth, I wanted to mention the fact Is it Keith Forsyth?
Keith Forsyth, uh-huh.
Yeah, the lockpicking didn't work. He had to take a crowbar, right?
Finally, to the second door that was the other way into the office. Yes, he had to. Finally, he could pick one of the locks on that door. Then he had to use a crowbar on the deadbolt. And then he had to push a huge, heavy steel cabinet that was blocking the door so he could get into the office at that point.
Bonnie, you posed as a Swarthmore student seeking employment by the FBI.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
We had done a lot of casing of the outside of the building and the traffic patterns of the police and all of that, coming and going of the apartment residence, but we really needed to know about the interior of the office. And so I was to pose as a Swarthmore student who was doing research on opportunities for women in the FBI, and I made an appointment to go in and interview the head of the office. And they were very, very gracious to have me come in and spend about 45 minutes inside the office. And I tried to disguise my appearance as much as I could, and I wore glasses, which I didn't ordinarily do, and I never took my gloves off the whole time I was taking notes in the office.
You put your hair up, too, I believe, didn't
you? I tucked it up into a woolen winter hat, and so I had enough time in there to know that there were no security alarms over the doors, no cameras, the file cabinets were not locked, and there were no security measures that we had to worry about.
And John Raines, you left with six large suitcases and then had to go to the somewhat onerous task of photocopying all of those and deciding who to send them out to. Talk about that, if you would, in terms of what
right. Well, as soon as work was done in terms of removing the files and placing them in suitcases and taking those suitcases out to cars, and then the cars out to a farmhouse that we had secured for sorting the documents. And actually, by the morning of the 9th, early in the morning, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we were already sorting files. And our purpose was to sort the files into what we thought were genuinely criminal files, about 40%, as it turned out, and then the other 60% that were clearly political files. We then mailed those political files to selected persons, a couple progressive politicians, and then to three separate national newspapers, besides the Washington Post, also the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times.
And it wasn't long after that the Pentagon Papers were sent by Daniel Ellsberg.
That's right. That's right.
Well, and I think that that's really very crucial because what happened, and maybe Betty talked about this because she was the one who received these, but no national newspaper, no newspaper publishing company had ever been faced with the problem. What do you do when you receive stolen federal documents? Do you, in fact, publish them? And it was clear that this was never something that had been talked about before, and there was quite a struggle inside of The Washington Post. Betty's still on, right?
Yeah, Betty's still on.
Betty, I'll turn this over to Betty.
You can talk about that struggle, Betty. We've talked about it before. You've written about it, but it was indeed quite a struggle.
Well, it was. It took place all in an afternoon and an evening, but it was the first time that a journalist had ever received secret government documents that had been stolen by people from outside the government. That means in contrast to a whistleblower inside. So that made them pause. I didn't realize that they were pausing. I was off writing my story and talking to people in Philadelphia who were named in the documents. But I learned at 6 o'clock in the afternoon that as of then, no story was going to be written, which was quite a surprise. The Attorney General had been calling the editors and as Catherine Graham herself all afternoon and demanding that they not be published. This also was the first time that the Nixon administration had demanded that she suppress a story. By 10 o'clock that night, she had decided to publish, and that also against the advice of her counsel. And the story was in the paper the next day.
And we should mention the Nixon administration tried to get the Post to return the documents, in fact. We're coming up on a break, and we want to afford you, our listeners, an opportunity to join this conversation, talking about domestic spying revelations 40 years before Edward Snowden. And we'll hear maybe what Betty Metzger and Bonnie Raines and John Raines have to say about the Snowden affair. But you may want to join the conversation, and if you have questions or comments, we welcome your involvement. You can join us toll-free. It's 866-733-6786 to be a part of this program. Again, join us by calling us 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org, or you can join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Betty Metzger's book is The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. We're talking with her and Bonnie and John Raines, and with you when we return on Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about domestic spying revelations over 40 years before Edward Snowden. And let me credit, by the way, RetroReports.org for documentary clips that we've used in this hour. In 1971, a group of burglars actually broke into an FBI office near Philadelphia and stole boxes of documents that revealed the federal agency's secret spying on dissident groups. And decades later, some of those burglars have revealed themselves to former Washington Post reporter Betty Metzger, who wrote the original story about the break-in and FBI FBI spying back in 71. She's with us. So are a couple of the burglars, Bonnie Raines and John Raines. And Betty Metzger's book is also out. It's called The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. We also invite you to join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You can do that a number of ways. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can go to our Facebook page. In fact, we asked listeners on Facebook what they think of such illegal acts as the 1971 break-in and how those actions compare to those of, say, Edward Snowden. And let me just read some of the responses. They're all favorable. John says the people who uncovered the facts about COINTELPRO are heroes, as is Snowden. After the revelations about Hoover's activities, things changed for a while. After 9/11, they changed back again. You better believe that the same tactics used against civil rights and anti-war groups in the 60s were used against the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And Ken writes, nonviolent action versus government lies to cover up mass murder is an easy trade-off to make. Snowden and Manning are heroes now, just as the FBI burglars and Daniel Ellsberg were heroes of their time. J. Edgar Hoover abused his power, just like the NSA's James Clapper and Keith Alexander abused their power by spying and blackmailing. And Kathy adds, Snowden, yes. FBI illegal invasion of privacy, no. And John Raines and Bonnie Raines, what are your thoughts about Edward Snowden?
I believe he has been a legitimate whistleblower in a very, very important way. And I think he was in a position to reveal the truth of what was going on, which was actually lied about in front of Congress at one point. And he was in a position to get the truth out there, and most of us are interested in the truth, particularly as it pertains to this massive, massive global spying and surveillance that's going on right now. And I think he did a terrific service to the country.
I'm sorry, John Ray.
I think that his purpose was very much like our purpose was back in the late 60s and early 70s when we decided to break into that FBI office and remove the files and send them to Betty. That is, our purpose was to give to the citizens of the United States the information they would need to make up their minds about what the folks in Washington, their representatives, should do and should not do. That was our purpose back in 1971. When we removed those documents and sent them out to the public with the help of people like Betty. I think that's what Snowden is doing, too. He said just as much. He said, I don't know what the changes should be, but I do know that the people need the information so that this discussion of the citizens can take place and they can tell the people in Washington what the people in Washington should do and should not do. So I think that in both cases, whistleblowers of yesteryear, whistleblowers of now, we operated for the same purposes and with the same goals in mind.
Well, a related question, Betty Metzger, I'd like you to address, given all your repertorial experience with these kinds of things. And Beth writes, the question one has to ask is how do we, as citizens, make sure things are done legally unless someone dares to do as Snowden and others before him have done in exposing how un-American these agencies who work for the United States can be?
Well, I think one of the big lessons to take away from both the media burglars and from what Snowden has done is the great importance of paying attention. I think Hoover was not paid attention to at all. And after that, the burglars started they ignited the first national conversation on the role of intelligence agencies in a democratic society. And Snowden has done that again. And it's just so important. And what we've learned about how if these agencies are not watched, what they resort to. And I think right now, instead of it being a hateful individual who is obsessed with declaring who's a subversive and trying to destroy them, which was literally the case, it's now, to some extent, people who are in love with the extensive reach of technology and what they can do with it, how they can invade privacy to the maximum degree. But the result is the same in terms of the damage it does to people. But in terms of paying attention, I really think that that pertains to all of us. You know, citizens can urge journalists to pay attention, to not just be willing to write about what is handed to them, which is true in my – that was my case, and that's also true of the people writing the good stories now about the information they're getting from Snowden, but to do more in investigative reporting about agencies. There hardly any people did that then. Jack Nelson of the L.A. Times, much hated by Hoover, was one of the few people who did that then. And I think that's also been true now. That has been – it's also very difficult to do it. But there needs to be more investigative reporting where journalists are developing sources within the agencies and they can and they try to discover what's happening on their own before somebody has to be a whistleblower who risk their freedom.
Well, some of the subsequent revelations that came out about the FBI are nothing short of astonishing. I'm thinking about, for example, the fact that as far as J. Edgar Hoover was concerned, enemy number one was probably, in his mind, Martin Luther King. And he indeed, and the FBI, because of King's extramarital affairs, said that King would have to commit suicide or those would be revealed. And I'm looking at a website comment from one of our listeners, Faye, who says there was a report by CBS in 1980 that during the Chicago Democratic Convention, the FBI had so many undercover agents in the crowd, they numbered one out of every eight protesters, and they fomented the crowd to urge the so-called police riot. I don't know. Is that correct, do you think, Betty, from your investigative reporting?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that the FBI was promoting violence. One of the ways that that happened that I think is particularly lamentable and outrageous is that there was so much there were so many informers placed in African American organizations and also anti-war groups, and some of whom were assigned to foment violence. So that there was so much of that that is almost impossible now, looking back, to know what violence, for instance, in black communities was actually generated by genuine disputes or generated by phony disputes created by the FBI. I'd just like to add to that that at the time I received those documents, and then even more so later as I did the research for the book and saw the wider picture of what was done, I ended up feeling that the worst thing that, that was done was to the African-American community as a whole. And that has many aspects. I'm speaking of things that were done to individuals like Geronimo Pratt in California, Fred Hampton in Chicago. Fred Hampton was killed. Geronimo Pratt was sent to prison for decades by the test of the false testimony of an FBI informer. But also just the massive surveillance. The first documents described the surveillance in Philadelphia. There wasn't any place that an African-American person could go in Philadelphia in their communities and not be spied on. I mean, it's specified in the documents.
Excuse me, Betty, that was all during the period of the MOVE movement too, wasn't it?
That came later.
Oh, was that later?
That came later. Yeah. That was later in the late 70s. And I'm not so sure that that involved the FBI. That was a Philadelphia oriented thing completely. I don't think the FBI was involved in that. I could be wrong about it. But in those years of the 60s and the early 70s, the surveillance was so great, and it was required that every FBI agent have one informer that reported to them regularly on what black people were doing. And in Washington, D.C. at that time, it was required that every FBI agent have six informers who reported to them on the activity of African Americans. And then when you see how Hoover influenced presidents, Eisenhower, for instance, to not step forward and take positive steps when black people pushed for their basic rights, you can't help but put this whole picture together and think that Hoover's FBI had a very significant impact on keeping black people from having their rights, perhaps for decades longer than otherwise would have happened.
I want to bring our callers into this, but before I do, there's an email from Dan who says, I read somewhere that Hoover's FBI also engaged in similar activities against the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups. Is that correct? Betty Metzger?
That's pretty much the lone right-wing organization that they conducted such activities against.
Let me go to our callers. We begin, Martha, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to thank the burglars for coming forward and Betty Metzger for telling their story. I was the college newspaper editor at Swarthmore when the burglary took place, and one day went to my campus mailbox and found a plain brown envelope with some of the stolen documents inside. And thank you, burglars, for including college newspapers in your distribution list, because we pursued the story without benefit of counsel and so didn't have any brakes put on us. And it remains one of the high points of my journalism career. But I'd like to point out that what the documents showed us is that among the informants following Swarthmore students' activities were the college registrar and the college switchboard operator. This was an era where every call that came into a student came through the switchboard. So you can imagine how pervasive the spying was.
Well, John Raines, also as a professor myself, I couldn't help wondering about the photocopy costs that you incurred. You did a lot of photocopying at the university, right?
The cost could have been much more severe, actually. We didn't know back then, hardly anybody knew back then, that every Xerox machine, the drum on each Xerox machine had its own fingerprint, so to speak. So any copy that was made on a particular machine could be traced back to that particular machine.
That's
we
right.
We didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
And that was one of the very close calls, actually, that had the FBI been able to trace some of those photocopies back to the religion department, At Temple University, I could have been in very serious danger.
Well, they had a sketch of you, Bonnie Raines, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Well, they had a sketch of me as I looked when I went into
right.
the office. I didn't walk around looking like that after that. But I was the only individual that they finally realized must be part of the group.
Let me bring another caller on from Berkeley. John joins us. Hi, Berkeley. John, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, that was part of my question. I was, you go into the backyard of John Edgar Hoover, and then you clip a couple of his favorite roses, and then you walk away, and you say to yourself, did you know you had a statute of limitations? How long you'd have to watch your backs? Were you a constant? I mean, did you need therapy? My question would be basically just, how did that go for how many years? And if you knew there was a statute of limitations that you would fail out on.
Well, we said earlier, you might not have heard, after 5 years, you were in the clear, Bonnie and John, right?
For the most part. We had a very good attorney who was experienced with civil rights and anti-war cases, and he was advising us. And he felt that after the 5 years that we were probably, for the most part, in the clear. And we just did not talk to each other. We did not talk to anybody else. It was a very important secret.
Your children did not know?
Eventually, when they were older, we did tell them about it.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from Christine on our Facebook page, Betty Metzger. She wants to know how you and the Raines ended up as friends sharing a dinner where Mr. Raines let slip sending the documents to you.
Well, I'd been a reporter in Philadelphia in the late 60s, and I met John and Bonnie during that time. We were just figuring it out recently. I think that I met them primarily through John being a teacher at a very innovative new department of religion at Temple, and I wrote several stories about that. So that's how I knew them, and they were people that I respected and liked and kept up the acquaintanceship over the years.
And by the way, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Peter asks, this to you, Betty Metzger, should I get my FBI file? I suspect I have one. Would I want to see it, and how do I obtain it?
I advise anybody to do that. You apply under the Freedom of Information Act. As of 1974, partially as a result of the burglary, the 1966 Freedom of Information Act was made stronger so that Americans can apply for government files, and including in intelligence agencies. Many people do that. Sometimes they resist. You have somebody in the Bay Area, writer Seth Rosenfeld, who wrote about the FBI and Berkeley last year, who ended up fighting a battle for 30 years in order to get the FBI files that told the story of J. Edgar Hoover's battle against Berkeley. But I don't mean to discourage you. I think it's a very important thing to do and highly recommend it.
And here's a caller from San Francisco. Noah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for my call. Real quick, in drawing parallels between the 60s and now with Snowden, there are a lot of accusations that these intelligence agencies are acting rogue and have overstepped their boundaries. You know, history tells us that Hoover was a shrewd, sneaky character, but we also know that Reagan, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon were happy to collaborate with him when it was in their political advantage. Now, even today, you know, are we accusing these agencies of being rogue, or, you know, can anyone speak to whether or not they think that these agencies are being directed by the executive? I think we're missing that. I think we're heaping too much scorn on the agencies themselves and missing the fact that Congress often does condone, even when they say they were unaware, and certainly the executive, I think, is in far more control than the argument indicates. And I'll take my question offline.
All right. We thank you for the question.
This is John Raines.
John Raines, go ahead.
Responding to that. That's a very insightful, very important question. One of the great debates of our era is now beginning, and that is how do you weigh the need for information and the ways in which you go about getting that information in order to protect a country? How do you weigh that against the fact that in the invasive technologies that we now have, aren't you destroying the very freedoms that you say you're trying to protect? Now, that's a scale that you got to weigh that competing interest there. It seems to me that what we found out because of Snowden's the files and so on, is that there's no restraints operative right now, or at least no restraints that were operative in the executive side and the institutional side of NSA and perhaps also CIA, and perhaps even now today also FBI. But there's a natural ambition. These guys are politicians. They're directors of large institutions. They want to expand their influence. They want to expand their budgets. There's a natural inclination to kind of do a mission creep. And then there's global competition amongst various investigative agencies. You know, we like to think that the United States is number one. We know a lot more about anybody else than they know about us and so on. Well, it's a global problem. And I think that there needs to be a new initiative in the United Nations that begins to bring international discipline upon what is, in fact, an international trafficking of ever more sophisticated, ever more powerful technologies that can track our emails, can track our online communications, read our mail, listen to what's going on right now, even if it wasn't broadcast, because I have a cell phone on and so on. That's the situation we're in.
Well, apropos of that, John Raines, I'm looking at a comment from a listener on our website, a listener named Ben, who says, do you think it would have been possible to pull off such an act of rebellion today with surveillance and the Internet? I highly doubt that it could happen. Does that mean our democracy is in danger?
Well, we were lucky that we snuck in under the wire.
Well, and it was unthinkable that the FBI, that their office could be penetrated and compromised. They never imagined that anything like that would happen. So they did not take the security precautions that they could have taken.
And let me bring Neil on here. Neil, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, are there any left-wing organizations you thought were violent enough to merit legitimate public surveillance by or private surveillance by the FBI?
Well, Betty Metzger, the Weathermen were certainly one group that was looked at as being potentially violent. They were making bombs and the like. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that's interesting to point out that when you read the files, it seems to be entirely focused on harassment and not on law enforcement or even an intelligence gathering, that the goal of these operations was to harass people in various small and large ways. For instance, some of the scholars who have gotten files over the years have concluded that it served no law enforcement purpose to the point that it never stopped a crime. For instance, those of us who are old enough to remember the bombings that took place occasionally during that time, none of them were ever known about ahead of time. I mean, you could say that there's a certain amount of human intelligence that probably was necessary and should have been effective. But that's not what was happening.
Well, with all the spying that was done that Snowden revealed on American citizens, particularly with those in authority saying it was done to sort of ferret out those who might be representing foreign governments or be behind foreign terrorist acts, they didn't find out about the Boston Marathon and the Chechens.
They cannot give examples of that. They really cannot.
No, and I was just saying the same thing pretty much with Snowden. I'm looking at actually another question about, we were talking about some of that leftist activity, and a listener named Bruce wondered if anybody had any comments, I guess again to you, Betty, on the Judy Berry, Daryl Cherney Earth First case against the FBI. After over a decade in court, they finally won their case. And for listeners who may not be apprised of that, that was an environmental advocacy group. In 1990, two of the activists were injured when a bomb they were transporting accidentally went off.
And what's your question, Michael?
Shed any light on that, Betty? The listener wants to know about, I guess, the fact that they actually won their case in court after a decade, proving the FBI was trying to do something to them rather than vice versa.
Right. I'm afraid I'm not an expert on that case. I do remember that they won their case, and it seemed like a very significant thing at the time. But I'm not an expert on what the FBI's enrollment was.
Well, let me bring another caller into this. Eileen, who was actually investigated by the FBI, Eileen, back then?
Hi. I'm not sure I was investigated because I never requested my file via the Freedom of Information Act. However, in 1985, a close friend of mine sent me an article from the Washington Post it had been reported that high school students in suburban Maryland outside Washington, D.C. had been investigated. So what happened to me, and I believe it was 1971, is that my next-door neighbor was a high school student involved in, you know, anti-war activities consisting of attending marches, marshaling up marches, leading walkout out of my high school after Kent State, gathering petitions, signatures, and delivering them to Congress. And in 1971, my neighbor was visited by two men posing as postal inspectors, asking rather personal questions about me. And
you were a target.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
You were a target.
It sounds like
and
it.
And, of course, as a very naive high school student, I thought that was pretty cool. My father was less amused, having lived through the McCarthy era, and he actually was an official at the Census Bureau, a federal employee, and he contacted his congressman the next day, and that led him to a discussion with an assistant postmaster general who, of course, denied that this had been an investigation. And that what was said was that they were trying to offer jobs.
Eileen, I'm sorry, in the interest of time, I'm going to have to wrap this up, but I thank you for the call and for your story, and there are probably many stories like that. And I want to also thank Bonnie and John Raines. It would be probably improper of me to thank you for what was technically a criminal act, but for your moral conscience, I want to express my gratitude. And thanks to Betty Metzger, who has always been one of our leading lights as far as journalism. Her book, again, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Thank you both.
Mike, let me also mention that there is a documentary that will be released, and the title of that documentary is 1971.
Thank you for being with us. And today, as we often do, we're dedicating a few minutes to read listener comments and feedback. Earlier in the week, you may remember, we featured venture capitalist Tim Draper and his idea of splitting California into six separate states. Several listeners complained that we were only giving Draper's idea attention because of his wealth. Ernst wrote, "This multiple California guy is a crank. Why is he on? It is only because he's a tech person with lots of money. He's been mocked roundly before, yet you're taking him seriously. What's next? Climate deniers? 9/11 truthers?" And on Tuesday, we asked listeners to tell us what stories we should prioritize in the coming year. And during that show, we heard from a caller named Joan who offered this critique.
"I feel you are trying to appeal to younger people, but younger people don't listen very long to anything, and they also don't listen to the radio. So you need to target the audience you have."
I responded by saying that public radio has a lot of young and loyal listeners, and we heard from several after the show. Ann said she was upset that people think millennials don't want critical critique on our radio programs. "Just because we're young doesn't mean we aren't going to carry the world any less on our shoulders. We're so tired of stuff being dumbed down. Stop it." And lastly, some feedback from yesterday's show with the authors of 50-50, How Working Parents Can Have It All. Tristan wrote, "The guests on today's program do not need to be introduced as female executives. Calling out their gender in this way is a symptom of the problems the guests are talking about. I'm fairly certain Michael Krasny would not introduce men in the same way." Thank you, Tristan. And finally, we would like to take a moment to remember journalist Susan Rasky, who died in late December. She was a dogged reporter and award-winning congressional correspondent for the New York Times before she left to teach at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, where she mentored scores of young journalists. Susan Rasky was a woman of spirit and integrity, and she was a friend of Forum. She often appeared as a guest on the show and occasionally filled in for me as host. She will be missed.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.